Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Tonight we continue our study of Hosea. We're in chapter 2, beginning at about verse 14. But we'll make a few comments from earlier in chapter 2, just so we can remind ourselves of where we are. In this chapter, chapter 2 of Hosea, we've seen that God calls the Jewish people a prostitute. It is as stark as that. And prostitutes in the book of Proverbs, prostitutes in the book of Genesis when we saw
Judah's
Tamar. It was his daughter-in-law, and she made herself to look like one. It is never a good profession. It might be the world's oldest profession, but it's not a good profession. We recommend street sweeping. We recommend librarian much earlier, much more. But here, in stark contrast to the purpose of Israel being the bride of the Almighty, is the hooker that sweeps in and distracts people from their relationship with their husband or their wife. He's jealous, he's aggravated, he is annoyed by the people who live in harlotry. Verse 5, their mother has played the harlot, she's conceived, acted shamefully, I'll go after many lovers. It sounds exactly, if you want to take a quick look at Proverbs chapter 7, which is in contrast to the wisdom of God, which is in chapter 8 of Proverbs. Look at chapter 7. The words of God are designed in verse 5 to keep us from an adulteress, from the foreigner who flatters with her words. For at the window of my house I looked out through the lattice, I saw the naive and discerning among the youths a young man who was an idiot, lacking sense. And it really means lacking heart. Passing through the street near her corner, he takes the way to her house in the twilight in the evening, and a woman comes to meet him, dressed as a harlot, cunning of heart. She is very clever. She's boisterous. She's rebellious. Her feet don't remain at home, which means she's always going out. She's now in the streets, now in the squares, lurks by every corner, seizes him, kisses him with a brazen face. This face, we call it in your face. Face. She says, well, I was due to offer peace offerings, but today I'm paid up. Therefore, I've come out to meet you to seek your presence earnestly, and I found you. She wasn't looking for him at all. She's flattering with her words. So I've spread my couch with coverings with colored linens. I've sprinkled my bed with myrrh, aloes, cinnamon. Everything's looking good, smelling good. I'm good. Come on, let's drink our fill of love till morning, as if. And let's delight ourselves with caresses. My husband's not at home. He's gone. He's on a long journey. It's you and I. We're consenting adults. No one will ever know. He's taken a bag of money with him, meaning he's fully provided for, and he's left me with plenty of provisions. At the full moon, he'll come home. So he doesn't need to come back and check in and take care of things here. So she persuades him. She entices him. This idea of enticing is one that I've pondered in this. Listen to the other meanings that this root, nata, can have. It means to stretch out or to spread out, to bend down, to bow, to stumble, to cast down, extend, follow, held high, lengthen, pitch, stretch, thrust aside, took aside, turn back, turn away. You get the idea. Yes. Perversion. That's what it is. Yes. Her flattering lips, she seduces him. Suddenly he's like an ox going to slaughter. Oops. He's in the wrong place, at the wrong time, with the wrong person. So this is the ministry, if you will, of a prostitute, to get us off the beaten path, to allure us with wrong. Now, with that in mind, look back to Hosea, and although that is the luring of the harlot, God says, I will allure Israel back to myself. Look at it in verse 14. By the way, it's verse number 16 in the Hebrew Bible. It's just the way the numbers work. But all the verses are still there. Verse 14. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her. The Hebrew here is not speak kindly, but speak to her heart. Now that is one of those great phrases in the Bible that is translated speak kindly. In one verse in Judges, it's translated speak tenderly about a husband and a wife. But it is speak kindly. When you speak to someone's heart, you're speaking kindly. We often hear people use that phrase, I'm not going to teach in a more academic way, I'm just going to share from my heart. What they're saying is, here's what's been going on in my life, and I want you to get it in your life. So it's person to person in a, I want to say, a biblical way. I'm not opposed to biblical sermon development. I certainly do that every week. But it is related to this heart-to-heart. In fact, sometimes we use that phrase when we say, I want to have a conversation with someone, heart-to-heart. Or can we sit down and have a heart-to-heart? Meaning, I want to speak kindly to you. I might confront you, but I'm going to speak kindly to you. So kindness here is called to the heart. Let me give you a couple of these verses where it's used. I think it's only four times, if I did my research right.
I think one of them is Joseph, when he spoke kindly to the brothers.
Well, no, that's in Le Shalom, in with peace. It's not Lelev, to the heart. I looked that up because that's what I thought in Genesis, but it's not. They couldn't speak kindly to him. Let's look these up. Judges chapter 19, which is the one I just referenced. Not a pretty sight, this one. Came about in those days, there was no king in Israel, and a certain Levite, staying in the remote part of the hill country of Ephraim, took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem. But his concubine played the harlot against him. She went away from him to her father's house in Bethlehem in Judah, and was there for 4 months. Then her husband arose, went after her to speak tenderly, that's Lelev, to her heart, in order to bring her back, taking with him his servant, a pair of donkeys, meaning, hop on, sweetheart, we're going home. So she brought him into her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he was glad to meet him. Father-in-law detained him. He remained 3 days. They ate and drank and laughed. So this is the wooing, this desire to bring her back, which is powerful, and it takes tender speaking to woo someone back. 2 Samuel 19, Joab, Absalom, King David, oh, my son Absalom. You remember that story? Joab comes into the house to the king and says, today you've covered with shame the faces of all your servants, who today have saved your life and the lives of your children, the lives of your wives and the lives of your concubines, by loving those who hate you and by hating those who love you. For you've shown today that princes and servants are nothing for you. I know that this day that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, you would be happy about it. Now therefore, verse 7, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. Speak to the hearts of your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go out, surely not a man will pass the night with you, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that's come upon you from your youth into naught. So the king arose, sat in the gate, and they said, whoa, the king is sitting in the gate. And all the people came, and it was good. He, King David, took the advice of Joab and went out and did it. Why? Because Joab spoke kindly to him. You see that? I believe that Joab is speaking kindly so that David goes and speaks kindly. So he had a heart-to-heart with him. Finally, Isaiah chapter 40, you might recognize this. Nachamu, nachamu ami. Comfort, oh comfort, my people. The beginning of what some call Deutero-Isaiah, meaning a second Isaiah, as if there were two. Some even say there were three. That is, that there was a compiler who took the words of Isaiah, whom we know as Isaiah, and a second Isaiah, and a third Isaiah, and melded them into one book. You and I believe that there was only one Isaiah who wrote it all. But because the language radically changes, chapter 40, verse 1, from the destruction and the almost hostility of God through Isaiah the prophet in the first 39 chapters, they hear this comforting, it's called the Nachamu section of chapters 40 through really the rest of the whole book. They say, well, it must be a different author instead of the same author, which is just like all the rest of the prophets. All the prophets are like this. You guys are in real trouble. You're going down. You're evil. Your priests are evil. Your kings are evil. Tell you what, God's going to look kindly on you. Every one of them. We could have Deutero Job and Deutero Jonah. We could have all of them, Deutero Hosea. But it's one prophet who spoke as many words as God told him at a time. Anyway, this is the Nachamu section. And you can see in verse 2, speak Alev, speak kindly to Jerusalem. Call out to her that her warfare is ended. So the message of a prophet is to say, enough already. Whether it's, I'm fed up with your sin, or I'm fed up with judgment and it's time to be gracious. Either way, speak kindly, speak to the heart of Jerusalem. So those are the references that I wanted you to see that are similar to this Hosea passage. Now we'll go back to Hosea. Because this is God saying now, even though you're a wretched hooker, prostitute on William Street, or for those listening in St. Kilda, Ackland Street, I will give her her vineyards from there. The Valley of Achor is a door of hope. She'll sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up from the land of Egypt. So the youth that we're talking about is the beginning of the Jewish people, right? Which is not Abraham's time, but Moses' time. The deliverance from Egypt. The Valley of Achor is going to be a door of hope. Let's look at Joshua 7. In Joshua 7. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan, the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, verse 24, his donkey, sheep, tent, and all that belonged to him, and they brought them up to the valley of Achor. And Joshua said, "Why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you." And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they'd stoned them with stones. They raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day, meaning to the day in Joshua's day. And the Lord turned from his fierceness of anger. And the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day. This was a terrible place. Achan, whom some in Middle America and in the South call Achan. Well, they call him Achan, and then they say Achan was the one who's in trouble, and that's why he's Achan. By the way, the Hebrew word Achor comes from this word, Achar, that's with an I in, Chaf, Resh, meaning to stir up, usually disturb. So it's called the Valley of Disturbance, because it's there that Achan troubled and disturbed the peace of the camp. He's the one who spoiled. He took some gear. He took some of the stuff. And it was supposed to be completely demolished. And Achan said, "Well, I'll just keep a couple little things for myself." So God, again, not happy with, "I mostly obeyed, never enough. Either you obey or don't. Don't muck around. Just keep a little bit of sheep for the sacrifice. Just a little. And I'll keep the king. There's a trophy. Yeah, the king. You know, we want him back." And God said, "What? Wait a minute." Samuel says, "What? Is that bleeding of sheep? Where'd that come from?" "Oh, yeah, well, I just kept back a little." So it's called disturbing, and by amplification, bringing trouble, doing harm, growing worse. That might be other translations of the word.
The Valley of Achor as a door of hope contrasts.
Well, this is what's crazy, that the Valley of Achor, where it was troubling Israel, is now going to be a door of hope. So Israel's response in thanksgiving will be like we rewound the tape and came back into the land of Canaan the first time. So instead of the Valley of Trouble, it'll be the Valley of Hope, a door of hope. So you get to try it again. I see it as a renewal, which makes sense in light of this Israel's messing around. We're like a prostitute. He says, "Tell you what, I'm going to give you a second chance. Go back home. Go be with your husband. Stop playing the harlot. I will give her her vineyards from there, and the Valley of Achor is a door of hope." A vineyard is not something that pops up overnight. A vineyard takes years to develop. I like that God gives us second chances, really third chances, 20th chances, hundreds of chances. You've heard people say, "Will God give the Jewish people a second chance?" Well, a second chance, He's already given the Jewish people hundreds of chances, thousands of chances. So if we say there will be, at the end of days, there'll be a rapture, there will be a time of Jacob's trouble, or there'll be this or that, and then the Jews will have their second chance, I think, what second chance? We've had hundreds of chances. To then argue that there must be yet one more is to misunderstand all the privileges that we've experienced and all the constant chances God's given us through every one of the 12 prophets, of the minor prophets, and then all the major prophets, and then Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as prophets, and Jesus as prophet. And you and I, sitting around here, around these tables, you and I are functioning as prophets, if you will, in a lost and dark world, giving every Israelite another chance and another chance. And so many won't, and yet God keeps giving them chances. So to argue from some particular theological bent that there must be a second chance I don't understand why people do that. The second chance theology is so minimizing the constant chance theology that God gives to his people. Verse 16, it'll come about in that day, declares the Lord, that you'll call me Ishi, my husband or my man.
That's right.
And you will no longer call me Baali. So now the relationship is not going to be master-servant, but husband-wife. Even though we can think of God as our master, and it's right to call him master and Lord. Jesus said it that same way, didn't he? You call me master and Lord, and you are right. He said, let's look at that in the Gospel of John, chapter 15, verse 12 and following. Yochanan, I want to say Yud-Heh, because I'm tired of people saying I can't say Yud-Heh is 15. Verse 12, this is my commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. So this idea of love is not functional, although at times it feels that way. It's not master-servant, though sometimes it feels that way. But it's relationally much more intimate. You are no longer slaves. A slave doesn't know why or what they do, but your friends, and we could say in Hosea's terms, you're my wife, you're my husband. Let's do another one here. Psalm 103 and verse 7. Sounds like typical Hebrew poetry, sort of a repeat of one into the other, but it's not at all. This is clear contrast. He made known his ways to Moses. His acts, I want to say, only to the sons of Israel. The Jewish people only understood what was the acts. They only saw what God did. But Moses knew God's ways. And this is the difference between a Baal and an Ish, between a master and a husband. A husband and wife are intimate. In fact, the word Yodea, he made known, Gerachav LeMoshe, his ways to Moses. Yodea is the word to know, and it's used sexually as well. It's the intimate knowing. So it's not merely academic, it's not merely information transmission, but it is person to person, it's heart to heart. And that's what God did with Moses, as opposed to the Jewish people. That's what Yeshua says in John 15 to his friends. You're no longer slaves. You're now friends. So now back to Hosea. No longer call me Baal, or Baali, my Baal. You remember Baal? What was he in charge of? Nothing. He's a dumb idol. He's a piece of concrete. In their world, what did the Canaanites believe about Baal, or Baal?
It was a god of fertility.
They used fertility. There were seven different peoples, remember, in the land of Canaan. The Hittites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, etc. So Baal, if I remember, was the lord of agriculture. Earlier in chapter 2, in verse 8, we saw a reference to grain, wine, and oil. Baal was the Canaanite god who controlled storms and agricultural and human fertility. I always thought of it as agriculture. So this was why we didn't recognize that God was the true source of our blessings. We thought of the Baals. So here God is making a clear distinction between himself and the Baals. In fact, he says in verse 17, I will remove the names of the Baals from her mouth so that they will not be mentioned anymore. Not even mentioned. That would be nice, wouldn't it? Don't we look forward to that day when nonsense religions are no longer named? And all the distractions of humanity and all the wrong.
Current India, people whip themselves till they bleed. They collect their blood in a silver bowl and they offer up to their God. When they were asked why, they said, because only through the shedding of blood is there remission of sins. The guy is whipping himself. He gets his 12-year-old son to whip himself and to whip his 5-month-olds to collect their blood. Then they showed footage of others who were mass suiciding, and they wrote a note saying, no one is responsible for our deaths. We have taken our lives to escape reincarnation, the judgment of reincarnation. Then they had others which were taking their children, 12-year-old children, and they were offering them up, as we read in the Old Testament, putting them through the fire in their worship centers. When you say that, that's what came to mind when I was watching that on Sunday. I said, there'll be an end to this.
And that's a hope. That's as part of the door of hope, is that we won't have Molech, we won't have Baal in the new Israel, in the future, when God cleans us up. What a day of rejoicing that'll be. And only if we can keep speaking kindly to her will this happen. Verse 18, in that day, I will also make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field, the birds of the sky, creepy things of the ground, abolish the bow, the sword, the war from the land, and make them lie down in safety. That sounds just like Isaiah, doesn't it? In chapter 2, and Micah, we saw chapter 4, said the same thing about beating your swords into plowshares. The two main weapons of war in Hosea's day were the bow and the sword. Today we have Scud missiles. Things that you can be as remote as possible, and therefore you can kill with a push of a button, instead of with a bow where you have to point and click. You have to point. And a sword where you have to be right up next to the guy. Bow and sword made killing personal. Gunpowder made killing impersonal. Gunpowder changed the world. These are the things in verse 18 that sound so similar to the rest of the prophets. God's going to be worshipped. People, especially Israel, is going to come back into relationship with God, and there'll be peace on the earth. You can't have peace on the earth without Israel coming back to God. Those Christians who think Israel is merely an interesting sidebar in the history of humanity and not at all in God's attention or affection in these days haven't read their Bible. Certainly haven't read the 12. Verse 19 is used
when the paper collects this.
That's it. So when we wrap ourselves with tefillin and we do the three wraps on the middle finger, we say the V'e Rastich, the and I will betroth you. It's as if we are reminding ourselves that God betroths us to himself in righteousness and judgment and all these things. If we would just live as betrothed, engaged to God. Betrothal was actually part of the nuptials, wasn't it? It's marriage without sex. And the purpose of these tri-part betrothals is that we will know the Lord. Would a prostitute hear this? Well, strangely it is. It's Gomer who's hearing this.
Isn't this one of the reasons of the triunity of God?
Who's betrothing? The Father's betrothing us. The Son's betrothing and the Spirit's betrothing us. Even as we see Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh. Verse 21, it'll come about in that day that I will respond or answer, declares the Lord. I will respond or Anna answer to the heavens and they will respond to the earth and the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine, the oil. By the way, those three, grain, new wine, and oil, are always a triad because it means all the agriculture by which Israel is defined. It is the earth for Jews. It's the economy for Jews. We didn't have computers and short sales. We had new wine, grain, and oil. That was it. And they'll respond to Jezreel. We talked about the Valley of Jezreel, the center of producing food last week. And then verse 23, again a quote that comes out into the Newer Testament, and that is, I will sow her for myself in the land. I'll have compassion on her who had not obtained compassion. I'll say to those who were not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. So remember in the beginning, at the end of chapter 1, we saw this lo ruchama and lo ami, no mercy and not my people. That was appropriate then when God says, in the future, we're going to flip the cards. And you were not, now you are my people. I will sow her for myself in the land. Verse 23. Is that unusual or what? What do you sow? You don't put out a head of lettuce, seeds. That's all you sow. So Israel, now redeemed, is going to be sown again in such a way that we're going to be harvested and be the beginning of a bigger harvest. So I see that, you might have trouble with this, but I have no trouble with it, that it is fulfilled in first century 12 disciples and tens of thousands of Jews who were the first fruits of the new people of God, who were not lo ami, actually they were lo ami, they were not his people, not only the Israel that had rejected Messiah, but the Gentiles who were far from God's people. That's right, so Paul goes out, actually Peter goes first, and preaches to Cornelius, and all these Gentiles come in the book of Acts chapter 10, and then they go back and try to sort this out, and they say, well, they're God's people now. They're in, because Israel was sown, the 12, the 70, the 500 were sown, and now over the course of these 10 years since the resurrection of Yeshua, now we've got some Gentiles coming in, Cornelius and his lot, and now we've got more happening in this city and that city all over Asia Minor. Who are they? Well, they are now Ami, my people. No longer can it be said of them that they're not his people, because Israel was sown. That's just a key phrase. And you sow a seed, Now, if Israel was originally capsulized or preeminently capsulized in Yeshua, we know that. That's part of our theology here, that Yeshua is the consummate Israel. He is the seed who was sown into the ground and then was raised up. And in his seeding, his being seeded, then he rises up and brings Israel along with him. And then Israel as a sown seed is bringing along Gentiles. And it is not for the sake of the Jewish people. It's not for the sake of ourselves. Verse 23, I will sow her for myself. Just simply, uzratia li, for me, God says, in the land.
That'll be the day.
That will be the day. It'll be after a period of time. We don't know when. We know that God is the one who's drawing us to himself and changing us over. And then in next week, we're going to look at Gomer being loved again. She comes back into more focus.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.